Hi, everybody, and welcome to 2022. We're here for our first webinar of the year, and we have a fantastic webinar tonight. I know it's fantastic because it's fantastic. We have a great guest, and we have over 400 people registered tonight. And number one, I want to introduce you to my wonderful co-host, Dr. Pat McBride. Say hello, Pat.
Hey, everybody. And, welcome.
And our wonderful guest speaker, who's going to, why are people saying they can't hear? Turn up the volume.
Okay, I can.
And, okay. So let me just go through the introductory slides. And this is going to be really a fun evening. A couple of months ago, I said to Dr. Herskowitz, let's do a webinar, an update on COVID. Some of you may remember we had a couple of webinars at the beginning of COVID, and they were great, and I thought that would be a good idea. So we planned it, and now this is such a great time because with what's happening with the Omicron surge and confusion, people just don't know what to do. I mean, depending upon who you talk to and what they believe is going on, everybody has a different opinion, and people are besieged by not knowing what to do, and people aren't talking to each other. It's polarized in our country, so I think it'd be good to just get the facts, and what everybody wants to do with the facts, it'll be up to them. And so, our speaker today is Avi Herskowitz. He is the president of ACAM. He runs a great functional medicine practice in California, and Pat will introduce him in a minute. And this is interactive, so we want your questions and comments. Please let us know what you're thinking, what questions you have, because this is how we share information in our community, and because the information will all make us more comfortable. I have a couple of polls I'm going to do later to see if you're practitioners, whether you invited your team and your patients to join us. For the rest of January, we have three more webinars, one with the Endeavor Pediatric section with Susan Maples. We have our monthly physical therapy section with Lenore Morrissey talking about the airway physical therapy report, how you assemble the data to share with other practitioners. And then at the end of the month, Dwayne Grumman's great orthodontist is going to talk about using a protraction face mask. All great webinars, so make sure you mark the calendar and join us for those events. And we skipped a couple slides. And remember, September 15th is Collaboration Cures 2022. And save the date. We're going to have a fantastic program, which should be up definitely by the end of the month. And the other thing that you should know, and that's webinar dog. And we have the Collaboration Cures University, online university, which is going to be up and running sometime in 2022. And Pat is one of the co-developers of that, along with Steve Carstensen. So stay tuned for more information on that. And so it's now time for you, Pat, to introduce Avi so he can share the information. We're going to save time for questions and answers at the end. Mm-hmm. And the webinars, if you're an AAPMD member, the webinars are free for everybody. If you're not, it's $35 for each webinar. It's a wonderful bargain to be an AAPMD member. But this webinar, we're going to make free to anybody who wants it because it's going to be such important information. So if you're a practitioner, give them the link so they can download this information. All right, go ahead, Pat. Let's introduce Avi.
Thanks for for putting up for the webinar, dogs. Unfortunately, it's at the worst time that it could possibly happen right now. So Dr. Herskovitz's extensive training includes a medical degree from the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and he served residencies in anatomic pathology and internal medicine, as well as a fellowship training in cardiology at the Johns Hopkins Medical Center. During his 12 years at Johns Hopkins, he became associate professor of medicine and immunology and molecular microbiology, and led a research team in the study of molecular and immunological mechanisms of inflammation, autoimmunity, ischemia, heart transplantation, rejection, and congestive heart failure. Over the past 15 years, he's helped establish and lead innovative nonprofit research and development organizations and that have domestic and worldwide social impact, which is super important to the AAPMD. He's president of the American College for the Advancement of Medicine, which ACAM, you've all heard of, and is one of the most respected integrative medicine societies in the United States. So welcome, Dr. Herskovitz. We're really looking forward to hearing your update on COVID tonight. Thank you so much. And again, apologies for the webinar dogs.
Well, I think so far everyone's excited about the webinar dog. And thank you, Pat and Howie, for the introduction. And thanks to the AAPMD leadership for organizing the webinar. I think, as Howie and you know, we did an ACAM webinar in the middle of December, I think to the day, 3 weeks ago. And the world is fundamentally different, and it's going to be fascinating to review how it's different and what we can learn about the last 3 weeks that inform us going forward. So let me just start. As I started the last webinar a few weeks ago, I went back to where we were back in March of 2020. So it's basically almost to the week 22 months ago where we began seeing Americans come back, fly back from Europe into the East Coast, into John F. Kennedy Airport and Newark Airport, and see the explosion of cases in New York City and New York State and New Jersey and the East Coast. So we had a rapid set of information coming forward. So we established a few hypotheticals that actually I wanted to test over time. So this is 22 months ago, and we suggested that natural immunity to any virus, in this case to COVID, would ultimately provide the best long-term protection. And ultimately, we learned a lot about the ACE2 receptor because it was clear about the mechanism. And we understood that that could be modulated because we had a lot of physiological data to reduce, ultimately, that would reduce morbidity and mortality. By the way, technically, is someone on, someone mute? I have a lot of background noise. Howie and Pat, can you look into that, please? Yes, hold on. Okay, we'll just continue. And then we knew right away that the elderly and patients with comorbid conditions were the most susceptible. We had that data almost immediately in the first month of the pandemic. So we also knew certain things that could make it easier for us to establish paradigms or strategies for treating patients over time, and that some of the complications from the virus were likely not due to direct viral injury, but due to the immune response. In this case, an abnormal one, or one that was going into a chaotic state, so to speak. So Howie, can you address whether I'm going to need to do this?
Avi?
Yeah.
That I think is one of your phone lines in the office. Are you using the 278714 number? Can I mute that number?
I don't know what phone number you're talking about, but we have no 650 number. So.
All right, I'm going to mute that number. That should make it be better.
Thank you. That makes it a lot better. Thanks so much. So that we also knew that there would be people, a lot of people with asymptomatic infection, and that would go unnoticed so that we could ultimately develop natural immunity perhaps faster, and that could impact the case fatality rates. In essence, there'll be the estimates are that there are three times as many people who have been infected than the pure cases that are counted are. So, and we also sort of decided early on as a community that if we try to decide this, to conquer this virus primarily with vaccines, that there would be a risk of collateral damage. And what that, this is again in March of 2020, about 9 months before any of the vaccines were available. And this is primarily due to the risk of delivering vaccines to the entire population, perhaps without long-term data to support them. And that the concept of putting the population into lockdowns was pivotal, particularly in the East Coast when we first began, in New York in particular, and they're useful short-term tools, but they cannot be long-term rational tools for a highly transmissible virus. And that's even more the case now with the Omicron variant, as we will see later on in the talk. So what do we really want to know? I mean, I want to know how I can protect the most vulnerable of the population, and how to, rather than trying to stop something that can't be stopped, and I want to identify who the people are and accurately assess the true risk, but also I want to know what my personal likelihood of being hospitalized is and what my personal risk of death is. I don't think it's that important to know what the entire population's risk. I want to know what my personal risks are and how I can best protect myself. And this has been fairly inadequately described by the media and by the medical public. So what do we keep on hearing all the time? Every day you hear the case fatality rate, and that doesn't answer my individual risk, because it's profoundly different if I'm under 30 years of age and have no morbid conditions, versus if I'm 65, 75, or 85 years old and have a set of comorbid conditions. It's profoundly different, as we'll describe in just a few minutes. The number of infections don't answer this question, and I'm, you know, pretty frustrated by the media's particular approach to this right now, where they're constantly talking about cases. Well, this is the first time we're adequately testing patients to a number that could have been a realistic months and months ago. So we've deluged the Walgreens and CVS's with seven different rapid antigen tests. So obviously the numbers of infections are going to go up. It doesn't answer my particular question of what is my risk. Now, when this slide was done just 3 weeks ago, there were 50 million confirmed cases. But the estimates from the CDC is that they're off by a factor of three, and the estimates are closer to 150 million cases. But yet, that doesn't answer my question either. And now I'll tell you in a few minutes that we now have 7.5 additional million confirmed cases over a three-week period. We used to have 3 weeks ago 50 million cases that were confirmed, and now we have 58 million cases. So this is, you know, this is a very highly transmissible variant. So striving to reduce the case numbers willy-nilly doesn't solve the problem, since there actually has never been any evidence that suppression is achievable in the long term with a viral infection like this without unsustainable costs. And that's what the society has been grappling with from the very outset. And now with the fast spreading, but we have to test this hypothesis out, the relatively milder Omicron. This is even more the case with trying to suppress it. But the question is how much more milder is Omicron? And by the end of this talk today, I hope that you'll have a better answer for that. So again, if you look at the top of the slide, and this is December, as of December 11th, because we gave the first webinar in December on the 15th, I believe 3 weeks ago exactly. The Omicron variant, depending on whether it was the 10th or the 11th, ranged from 1% to 2.9% of the cases in the United States. So the overwhelming majority of cases were the Delta variant. And now we don't have the number on the Delta variant, but now the data suggests that a minimum of 75% of the cases in the United States are due to Omicron. Now, it's probably closer to 90% now, but let's just say this variant makes a lot of sense that this variant would spread this rapidly from the original description back in early November from South Africa, given its transmissibility with its collection of 30 plus mutations. So I don't think the top bullet is of great importance, but this is as of today. We have this current hospitalization number. This is national, and it's 14, almost 15,000. The numbers to think about here is a month ago, it was half, and 2 months ago, it was roughly a third. And even 2 weeks ago, it was it's a third higher than it was even 2 weeks ago. And yet it's less than it was this time last year. So we're at the peak number of cases. And again, the media goes wild about the number of cases. Well, we're also testing 10 times as many people as we did before. The total number of hospitalizations is still less than compared to a year ago, but it's rapidly rising. And the question is, why is it rising with a milder illness, even though it's not comparable to where the Delta variant was some months ago, or perhaps even a year ago? So this is the pattern that everyone is now accommodated to with the pandemic in 1918, and you see the so-called three waves, where the middle wave in 1918 was the more infectious and the more virulent and the more deadly. And if you're going to focus on the next slide, you're going to see that from 1918 through 1919, it looks similar to where we were from around 6 months or so ago, with wave number four, wave number five, and now number six. Well, we have a lot of waves in the United States, perhaps more than any other country in the world. But the patterning is a pattern, particularly in the last 6 months or so, which is similar to the pandemic in 1918. And the good news is, in 1918, the last wave was the final wave. So we're going to argue whether or not this is likely to be the case in 2022 and by the end of the talk. Now, when you look for patterns, though, worldwide, other than the United States, this is the U.S., and you could see discrete patterns, and they're somewhat similar on the right side of the slide to 1918. You don't see similar patterns worldwide. So this is four countries. The blue is U.S., Germany, the green is United Kingdom, and then Sweden on the bottom. They're randomly chosen to show what can't be described as a pattern. Germany is flat with Sweden on the bottom and then rises back around a year or so ago. And then there's no clear pattern here. And the question is, why is that the case? And more importantly, how is the lack of patterning confused the population? And what is the basis for it? And is this normal, quote unquote? And I think after a few more of these slides, I think you'll get my opinion that it is normal and it is not unexpected. And yet it has led to a great deal of confusion as to what we anticipate the virus to do during the next phase, has created a feeling of extraordinary fear that perhaps could have been mitigated better with more information. So here we go. This is just basically less than a month old, 50.5 million total positive cases. Of course, the estimate is off by a factor of three, more likely, although that can't be proven. And this was a total number of deaths, 815,000. Well, that leads, and the average number, the 7-day average of hospitalizations was 7,500. Well, that leads to, well, if you have this many deaths and that many positive cases, it leads to an overall fatality rate of 1.6%. And if you use the higher number of 150 million positive cases, it estimates that the true fatality rate is just a half of 1%. But again, while that's interesting stuff to know, the question will ultimately be, well, what is my personal what is my personal risk, or what is my loved one's personal risk? But when you then compare it literally to less than a month away, look at the numbers, 50.5 and 815,000. Well, you have 58,000 as of today and 850,000. So there's an additional 35 some odd thousand deaths this particular month, which is not extraordinary for our patterning over the last 2 years. But the number of cases, being 7.5 million more cases, is extraordinary. And while we have higher hospitalizations, perhaps almost a complete doubling of hospitalizations nationwide, the overall fatality rate now is significantly lower in the last month. So this is over the last month, the fatality rate has dropped by a factor of three to 0.5%. And then the estimated, with triple the number of positive cases, it would be closer to 0.2%. So we know for sure that in the last month with Omicron, the overall fatality rate has dropped, so that despite the number of hospitalizations going up by a factor of two in the last month or so, the fatality rate is less. And so we understand that that's a good sign, and yet still double the number of people exposed to this particular variant have ended up in the hospital as compared to before Omicron showed up. And that speaks to the transmissibility and to the risk of the population that's being exposed. And at the end of the by the end of the talk, I think you'll understand who is more likely than not still at risk for hospitalization, even though the death rates are remarkably lower. So, okay, here we go back again, back in to November 2020. So this is quite a long time ago now. It's 15 months ago. This is a slide I probably showed a year and a half ago or so. But this slide is important for a few reasons. The pattern is the same. And when you look at the right-hand side, you realize that more than 80% of all the deaths were in the 75 plus years of age group, even though, again, this is relatively small proportion of the population. And I think it's closer to 90 some odd percent of the cases were above 65. And then you look at the left side and you say, well, this is a spectacular difference between the younger population, certainly below the age of 35, versus the age above 35. And obviously the steepest difference is above 65. Now, age is not a great predictor. It's just a summation of different factors. But basically, if we focused on greater than 65-year-olds, we would have a 65-fold higher, would be focused on a group with a 65-fold higher risk as compared with less than 30 years of age. But we're going to focus a little bit on the far most left side because the more recent FDA recommendations for vaccinations of the 5 to 11-year-olds and boosters in the 11 to 15-year-olds speak to arguments that I think will be very difficult to sustain. So here we are back in November, and you see the number 80% and so on. And the next one is the same data at that point. So you have 97% of all the patients that passed away from COVID-19 as of that moment in time were in the 45 to older group. So 30 times more people in this older age group, quote unquote. It's all relative, of course. And again, the spectacular, even a five-fold difference between the 10-year span between 45 and 55 versus 75 and 85. So we understand that age, which is a surrogate of morbidity, of comorbid conditions, but when you look at the left-hand side, you realize that we're talking about a difference of two log order differences between the populations. And that's been the one silver lining of this particular pandemic, despite having tremendously negative impact on the society and on individuals and families. We have not had to consider very strongly that this would be fatal in any number of significant number of younger folks. So now we're back in the present. So the number, instead of 97%, is now 93.3% in the 50 and above group. So we'd still end up treating, we'd have a 16-fold increase in the way we would impact on deaths if we focused on the greater than 50 years of age group versus the younger one. And now when you look into the middle of the left side of the slide where it says FDA authorizes the Pfizer booster for 12 to 15-year-olds, and now FDA authorizes pediatric vaccines for the 5 to 11 group, you realize that this is not clearly a strategy to reduce the number of direct deaths related or direct hospitalizations related to COVID in this particular age group. There has to be another set of rationale in order to do this. Perhaps impact on the rest of the society, but certainly not direct impact to the group itself. And we need to figure this out as a community. So I'm going to focus for the next few slides on this group, because I was stunned at this revelation that the FDA countermanded their own advisory group and authorized this type of thing. Again, it's a pediatric dose. It's one-fifth or one-third the adult dose. And there are two numbers that come out of CDC. This is just CDC graphs. So one of them is over a 11-month period almost, from January to October. A little bit longer period, but there are 94 deaths in the 5 to 11-year group. And we'll understand this a little bit better in the next slide. But the other number was in the last year, from October to 2020 to October 21, there were 66 COVID-19 associated deaths. Now, when you look at this information, when you look at the slide over to the right side and you look at causes of death, it's equivalent to suicide deaths in that age group. It's also by an order of magnitude 30-fold increased versus the major four causes of death. So when you look at this information and begin to absorb it, it's a relatively low-risk population, even though for deaths, and even though some of the children have this multi-system disorder that's poorly understood. They end up to be hospitalized, and that's awful and an enigma at this point. But the death rates remain remarkably low. And so when you look at influenza, this is back when there was no influenza. There was no flu last year, essentially. And it's still, COVID still lost out to influenza a year ago. And of course, was off by a factor of 30 to the four major causes of death. So the question is, why vaccinate this particular group? And it must be related to their impact on teachers when they go to school, their impact on older parents and grandparents, et cetera. And I will not get into the details of this, but this is a difficult thing to rationalize based on the historical information over the last 22 months. There's little validation that I could find, but again, I'm not going to get into that today because it would take another hour to go over it. But so here you have young people with this type of percentage chance of recovering. The emergency use authorization gives full liability protection. And historically, certainly in the 2017-2018 flu epidemic that we had in the United States, the numbers of deaths and hospitalizations were probably 100 times higher in that particular flu season in the younger age group. So now let's get back to the adults for a minute. And we all have seen this ACE2 receptor cartoon, a beautiful graphic. And that's the little bit that the spike protein is attaching to this particular receptor on the bottom in yellow. So what is this receptor and why is it so fundamentally important to how we look upon treatment, how we look upon prevention, how we look upon who's at risk and so on. So perhaps I hope you can see the slide is not too small, the text isn't too small. We know that that receptor has powerful anti-inflammatory and modulating effects, but it also has metabolic effects. It also has circulatory effects. And also has coagulation effects. So it's basically in the center of many of the communications networks of the body. It doesn't, you know, it spares certain pathways, but not many. And so when the virus reduces this level, the beneficial effects of this particular receptor has during normal life is lost. And that's what happens when the virus attaches to this receptor, and it can produce a state of inflammation. And in some cases, you've heard the term cytokine storm, of course, but that's in the most severe cases. But the question is who's at risk and why is age such an important factor? Well, because I think 90% of the aged population in the United States has what we call metabolic syndrome, which is diabetes or prediabetes, heart disease, and hypertension and obesity. So these first four are in some 9 out of 10 adults in the United States past the age of 65. So this is why age is a surrogate of risk, even though you can obviously have these morbid conditions if you're 50 or 45 or 40 or 30. Interestingly enough, I'll show you that off to the right, the COPD, cancer, and immune suppression did not increase one's risk that dramatically as compared to the four on the left side. And that all of these long-term risks that precede the virus, catching this particular virus, basically represent an ACE2 deficiency in the first place, which is then made worse by the virus itself. So this is clearly those folks that do the poorest are the ones that pass a tipping point that cannot be reversed unless it's treated early. And so now we have groups of physicians writing the protocols for ICU care that don't rely so much on intubation, but rely on immune modulation. But these groups of physicians and ICU doctors have had to do these protocols on their own. So what are the relative risks? Of course, age and pre-existing conditions. It's also the region in which we live in. We have a very, very large land mass with multiple different weather patterns and food supply issues and genetic populations that vary. So race, standard of living, what your environment is, where you are, what the true prevalence is in the population at that particular moment in time. We didn't see a bump. I'm based in San Francisco, and we didn't see a bump in any hospitalizations across the city until a few days ago, where we now see trickles of patients entering the hospital with Omicron. The two on the bottom are fundamental and important. One of the things that is clearly a predisposing factor, even more with the more recent Delta and Omicron, is the obesity factor. And then the low vitamin D levels have repeatedly been shown to be a risk, and that's because vitamin D is more of a regulatory hormone. It's not just a vitamin. It has also, it's similar to the ACE2 receptor in the sense that it's more like a conductor of the orchestra of communication in the body, including immune, hormonal, metabolic, and so on function. And listen, it's one of the few things that increases lifespan. It's not a bad thing to have. And we all might as well target ourselves to the target level, which I'll describe at the end, what my target is for that vitamin level. But when you look at the top four on the left side, we realized right away, even I think as early as April, they published data from New York City that said 93% of the population that was that passed away from the first real major surge through May of 2020 in New York City had at least one of these morbid conditions, and actually the majority of people had three or more. So when you look at the left side, the top four are the most important ones, because they're also already tell you that your ACE2 receptor is not functioning well. And neurological disease is really a history of stroke, which is a vascular phenomenon and actually an age surrogate. But when you look at lung disease and asthma on the right side and so on, and immune suppression, these didn't come up as strongly. And when you look at immune dysfunction with autoimmunity, it was relatively a trivial risk factor. So, and then I said that we didn't really see a real pattern globally, and this is due to certain things that we have to understand. And you cannot just bundle the whole world's population, even a country's population, into a pattern that you think is reproducible, because everyone is fundamentally different on top of regional variations. So there are regional variations to the virus itself. I mean, when you have Delta in the UK, it's going to be slightly different than Delta in New York, slightly different than Delta in San Francisco. The immunogenetics is profoundly important. There are people who will respond to any given virus in 10 different patterns, depending on their genetic profiles and their responses to cytokines, activating certain cytokine profiles to any particular virus. And that's true whether it's flu, or whether it's a stomach flu or influenza flu or a COVID infection. There's also tremendous variability in the vaccines. You know, not only the brands in Europe were different, the dosing regimens were different. AstraZeneca was given first with 4 weeks, then 8 weeks, then 12 weeks in between dosing. We have different dosing regimens and different amounts of spike protein in each of the three different approved vaccines in the United States. So we have to anticipate differences, and we're not typically measuring these things. And then there's heterogeneity of the receptor. Receptor is not a simple thing. There's as many different subproteins that make it different from one person to the other. And then how many people have had asymptomatic infection in the community? How many people have had the virus before the vaccines came into play? And then you have this thing on the bottom, which is also pretty important, because the food supply in the United States is inflammatory in nature, as most of you already know. And this is the major source of inflammation that we currently have as a society. So if you look at the middle thing, is just to make a point, I could have chosen, I have a red here for South Korea. You could choose Japan, Taiwan, China, any number of different Asian, Southeast Asian countries. And then you realize that this is off by a factor of 30 to the UK and USA, and even we didn't even put Brazil up here. But this begs the issue of, do they have the same virus, or do they have different genetics, or what's explanation here? So very little information has been pouring in on this level, but it doesn't. Right now, we know where we are in the United States. We know that we have a tremendous amount of metabolic disorders in the United States, and we understand that we top the list in terms of the total number of deaths worldwide. So again, when you look at the pattern, it's very difficult to come up with a pattern, and that's not surprising given all the variations that we discussed before. And so don't get thrown off here. Just worry about your own region, and worry about your own age group, and worry about your own risk factors, and then you'll have a much better handle on what your risks are and what the risk going forward is with Omicron. So I need to take a little bit of a break and say, okay, what do we have for testing so that we understand where we are? So the testing is such that we all know that the PCR test is very sensitive, it's not specific. And then this famous slide that most of us have seen before, you can't read it on the bottom, but the bottom is the number of cycle thresholds that you submit the blood sample through the PCR device. And when you notice, when you go to 30, 35, and 40, we're on average at 37 throughout the U.S., you're really, when you look at the percent on the top, which is culture positive, it's very rare to find a correlation between a PCR test that's positive and whether it's infectious or not. And that you need to have symptoms for. So if you have symptoms, a PCR test is good at telling you whether you have symptoms from COVID, but it doesn't tell you very much if you're not symptomatic, whether or not you're infectious. But that's the easy test that we came up with. And we came up with a test dramatically to focus on whether or not you have a single a viral DNA particle. It's not to test whether you're infectious or not. So then you say, well, what about, am I immune? You know, I want to know this because so many people have been infected. I've been infected or I've been vaccinated. Am I immune? Well, we're only using large scale neutralizing antibody responses. And that's ultimately, after today's talk, you'll realize that this is because it's easy to test for these, but very nonspecific. So while antibodies are part, antibodies are important, and neutralizing antibodies is what we want to focus on, but that's as a very small part of the cascade of both antibody or humoral and T-cell lymphocyte immune responses. And let alone the other things called complement activation and macrophage or phagocyte recruitment. All these things are much larger cascade, and it would take another hour to go over it in detail. But suffice to say that every immunologist in the United States understands this, but you can't get much of this information on CNN. So we can unravel these things, including the subcomponents of the spike protein and all the different antibodies you can measure and so on, but it's just complicated to do, and we as a society have decided to make the message simple. Do you have antibodies? Yes. If you do, then you're immune. If you don't, you're not immune, but that is patently false. So when you focus on the red, there's basically a lack of immune correlation between protection. So neutralizing antibodies don't prove that you're going to be immune, nor their absence prove that you're not immune, because on the bottom is an important bullet, and that is that T cells of the cellular immune reaction complements the neutralizing antibodies. So normally, neutralizing antibodies are supposed to bump up right away, and then T cells take over. So they're supposed to go down over time, and they go down over time in different phases with different populations. So if my IgM and IgG antibodies are not present, does that mean I'm no longer immune and that's why I need a booster? Well, that's what that's what we hear all the time in the media. Well, you know, the new shot, the antibody levels are going down, so we need a booster. So that's the argument that's being used. And yet right now, the fact is that there is one T-cell test available, but it's not widely available and not widely used because it's the cytotoxic T-cells that dictate and the helper T-cells that dictate long-term immunity. And they do so because that's the one that binds the virally infected cell and also contributes to long-term killing. So this has been largely ignored by the population. So we have a lot of information here. I need to skip over a lot of it to make sure we make it in time. But the bottom is really important. And ultimately, so many of the population have had some either vaccine-associated T-cell protection or natural immunity to COVID infection with T-cell protection, that is one of the explanations as to why Omicron is not as virulent as the Delta variant. There's also the mutations, of course, that make it less virulent. But this is one of the more important things that are not being measured. So how do we unravel this? Well, there are assays to do this, but they're just complicated to do. And I think the problem is that the message that the public health community wants to offer, which is vaccinate and boost, it gets more and more complicated as you get into the data, and they don't want to go there. So then we go back to the hypotheticals that we created back in March of 2020, and we wrote that a lot of the complications would be due to persistent and abnormal immune reactions and not so much the virus. Well, here we go with the New England Journal paper in August, which says we have now the long-haul COVID. And this is perhaps the most poorly understood of the COVID presentations, which means, so it has to be defined. So they defined it here as in a minute, but they said that this is back in August, that they expected 15 to 20 million cases of this following the pandemic. The average age is quite young. And so this is disrupting the workforce, and it's going to cast a long shadow. So the NIH put forward somewhere between $1 and $3 billion and gave it to most of the large academic centers to produce long COVID clinics. Well, you still have a group of people with no explanation as to why they're fatigued, why they're breathless, why they have the 6 to 12 and 18 months after the original infection. And so they defined it as this. It's not one thing. It's not blood clots or myocarditis or whatever. It's a range of symptoms. And then they said it was relationships to what's called basically chronic fatigue syndrome, which is, again, poorly understood by the medical community, better understood by members of AAPMD and ACAM and so on as a multi-system type of effect. Whether it's post-viral or associated with some toxin, oral toxin for that matter, and that they want the CDC and NIH to focus on this going forward. So these are the lists of the things. I think that when you're stuck in the ICU with lung injury, with pneumonia, you're certainly at risk for permanent lung damage, and you'll need extensive physical therapy. But this concept on the bottom is important. The brain inflammation or causing brain fog or cognitive decline is very, very common. And now we get a lot of material in the press talking about myocarditis, which is my old area of interest. And I've written maybe 50 papers on post-viral myocarditis, not with COVID, but COVID seems to be particularly prone to produce this autoimmune state. But there are many other autoimmune conditions that are being described, whether it's due to the virus or due to the vaccines. The vaccines are more difficult to tease out in terms of prevalence, but these are the most commonly known ones. And I can't get into myocarditis that much because we don't have the time. But I have to say that we do know that after COVID infection, antibodies are up in 50% of all the hospitalized patients, and they're as high as they normally would be with real autoimmune disease. So, and those of them that develop into long, it's probably some kind of an ongoing autoimmune state. Excuse me. This is a slide which you can look at when we free up the slide deck. There are many different cardiac complications that happen, and I've seen them all, actually. So I'll suffice it to leave it at that and this one, too. But the concept of getting a virus or getting the vaccine and then beginning a self-attacking set of antibodies, in this particular Stanford study, it's 1 in 5 hospitalized patients that actually had these things. So you say, well, okay, all right. You know, you've convinced me that that we have now a new variant that is less virulent, less likely to produce mortality. Perhaps not quite as bad as it was a year ago, but almost as bad right now, producing hospitalizations that are increasing. What am I supposed to do? And because I get barraged every day, I'm sure you get barraged every day about what you should do. So this is to remind me to talk about a certain triangulation between the biome, whether it's the gut, the oral biome, vitamin D and the ACE2 interactions, whether it's from the virus or vaccines or from boosters. This dictates whether or not you're going to have an ongoing immune reaction. So without taking care of this type of knowledge, you're not going to do as well as your neighbor who will understand this and your patients that will heed your warnings that this is very fundamental. So I just take one aside, and I'm not going to take an hour to talk about the vaccine adverse event rates, except to say most of the patients that I see with vaccine-related abnormalities are not reported to the VAERS when they come to see us. So it's probably vastly underreported, but you need to look at individual risk and understand, because there's no predictor of your risk. There's no way to predict who's going to get a post-vaccine type of complication. But I do suggest, and I do look at, if someone asks me what's my risk, I ask them to draw certain bloods. And the C-reactive protein is an inflammatory marker. So is ferritin, an oxidation marker. The D-dimer is a coagulation marker. And overall, your innate immune system could be sort of a single measure. It could be natural killer cell counts or something called CD57. But that would be a helpful set of tools to have. So the next thing is, I guess, what we all want to know is, what do I think or what do I do and so on. So let's first describe what the groups of doctors that have coalesced together, these critical care physicians, in this case, the Frontline Critical COVID-19 Care Alliance, which is a group of ICU attending physicians in major ICU centers. And they say, listen, you know, might as well have something that's antiviral, something that is antioxidant and so on. And we all know that quercetin has a lot of preclinical data or animal data and a lot of tens of years, decades of work that understands that it's relatively anti-inflammatory. And in this case, along with zinc, is antiviral. So might as well be on these things. And they recommend about 1 gram of vitamin C twice a day. And most of the rest of us would double that recommendation to 3 to 4 grams a day. And this is, you know, I can't say it's going to prevent a viral infection. It's going to, it perhaps will make, because we may all eventually get exposed and maybe all get ultimately Omicron, some form, hopefully asymptomatic. But this should be part of everyone's formulary at minimum. This is what they say. And now we'll add something else. So then I say, well, how about modulating the immune system back down a bit So if you get a sort of a big dose of Omicron variant, whether you can modulate it back down, vitamin D is certainly one of the fundamental things. And I target, I think the lab data shows that the target has got to be above 40 in my own recommendation is to keep it higher than that, 60 to 100. And then you have these other things, these antioxidants and detoxificants, glutathione, the precursor called N-acetylcysteine. These are fundamental, magnesium, melatonin. The sulforaphanes are the broccoli derivatives, and they're all anti-inflammatory and modulate the immune system back down. So melatonin isn't just for sleep. It's an anti-inflammatory. It's a immune modulator. And then I think, again, it's logical. It's certainly not a cure for a virus, but if you use the colloidal silver preparations and you gargle with them, if you have, if you want to protect your oral cavity, again, particularly if you really feel you have an early flu or an early viral infection, and you could use it intranasally as well. So I think that this is logical. It makes sense. And then because of the effect on the coagulation system, I think either low-dose aspirin or some of the fibrinolytic herbal preparations, as well as omega-3 fatty acids, make sense. And this is not supposed to be a list that's inclusive. It's just logical to say that these are things that you should have around, that you don't have to run to Walgreens for in a tizzy. I will show this one slide because, again, it was presented, this type of meta-analysis was presented, some 24 studies from 15 countries, none of them in the United States. Our own NIH has a study on ivermectin's efficacy in prevention and treatment that it'll be due to be published sometime in, I think, late 2022 or 23. So we're not going to have that data that'd be useful in the United States per se. But there's a lot of controversy about this, and just like hydroxychloroquine, that'll remain controversial because we're not going to have studies in the United States telling us what we should do in our own population. This one is to me was the turning point for me to begin talking about vitamin D on social media, and then having social media show that this information is dangerous, because here 50% of the patients without being given vitamin D in a Spanish study in an ICU study done in Spain, 50% of them had to be in the ICU versus 2% of the patients that were treated with high doses of vitamin D when they entered the hospital. This is, exceptionally benign type of treatment that can give an effect that you could predict would work based on the knowledge of vitamin D. You can have 10 binders in your office on the positive effects of vitamin D on immune function as well as metabolic function. So, okay, what do I have? We have this thing. It came up in about 6 weeks or so ago. We know it was more transmissible. We know it was more rapid. You get the onset in 2 days versus 5 days. That means you get a higher viral load and it peaks early. And then what kind of symptoms are the most 5 common ones? And you notice that coughing is not on the list. Headache is probably the number one symptom that we're having now, but runny nose, fatigue, any variety of different levels of fatigue, sneezing, and sore throat. So I think sore throat and headache and runny nose are the most common, although fatigue can be the only symptom, and that's why it looks very much like a cold. In the population my population, at least, the ones that I know about and the ones that talk to me every day are the ones that also take some supplements. So I don't have a completely naive understanding of what's going on in the population at large. And so we know it's 3 to 4 times more transmissible. We know the doubling time is very, 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 and that's why we end up basically transmitting this virus in a three-week period throughout the United States, from 1% or 2% to 75 or 90%. And then within 1 week of the discovery, it spread to 6 continents. The problem is that it spread with the hysteria of the media and with all the studies that had not yet been done and all the positive inputs that we have from the earliest data from Europe and South Africa that suggested that this was not benign, but in different populations would act differently and overall would be less virulent. Now, this is perhaps the most interesting slide of the whole bunch, and that is that in certain places in the country, 90% of the cases are now in fully vaccinated patients, and then at least half have had a booster. So it's as clear as it can be that we cannot vaccinate and boost our way out of the Omicron variant exposure. It just can't be done. So why is it that we still only talk about boosting and now boosting the 11 to 15 year olds and now giving vaccinations to the 5 to 11 year olds is a bit difficult to absorb. And I think something that has to be followed carefully. It's just not clear what the positive impact is going to be, because you have to have another strategy, just simple mathematics that the average person has already been vaccinated and boosted that is getting this Omicron case and then is at risk for hospitalization. So what do we think out of all this immediate tragedy of a lot of collateral damage? A lot of schools are now going to be closed because the teachers think it's too dangerous to go to school. We'll have a lot of collateral damage. At the same time, the population will boost its immunity. Now, understanding that SARS-1 and MERS, the original coronaviruses, that happened earlier in the decades, while they produced neutralizing antibodies to COVID-19 even a decade or two later. So cross-reactivity from Omicron to other variants in the future is probably going to happen. We don't know for sure. There's early studies that suggest that that's going to be the case. But suppressing the numbers of cases is not going to lead to very much effect. So we have to anticipate that we need to live with this non-life-threatening virus for the most part. And so the good news is we have newly approved 2 drugs, one with Pfizer, one with Merck. The Pfizer drug is a lot better. Monoclonal antibodies only one of the 3 of them work with Omicron, and the convalescent plasma has worked in the past. But there is very little data with using it in Omicron. So right now, it suggests that it's only at 50%. But basically, this Paxlovid is 88% reduction in hospitalizations and deaths. So you'd think that we need to get this into everyone's household. It will need a prescription, and in different regions of the country, you'll have a lot of problems getting it. And I know that there's a few pharmacies that anticipate getting it in San Francisco, and I may or may not be able to get it for patients. I'm just not sure yet. But in certain regions of the country, they just don't have enough. So we only ordered 3 million of these cases, of these treatment regimes from Pfizer, which is the one of choice. And yet we've ordered a billion some odd doses of vaccines, which now we know are not effective in preventing Omicron hospitalizations. So now it's 50%. It may be higher, maybe lower. But we had an office person come up with Omicron, a young administrative person, and I said, "Well, you should go down to the blood bank and get your plasma taken because you almost certainly have very high levels of neutralizing antibodies, and you can protect the next person." But this is also very difficult to find. So I have some preferred things that I like. This will probably post onto the website, whether it's APMD or ACAM. The center is vitamin D. And please note that this is 50,000 IUs, and I have a German approach to using megadoses of vitamin D when I'm exposed to anything in the winter. And then you have some colloidal silver on the left side. We have quercetin. We have zinc. We have things that contain the sulforaphanes, the broccoli seed extracts. We have things that contain resveratrol, glutathione, and actually the simplest thing, which is vitamin C. This is, you know, this is possible to have some things in your system that will prepare you. So to end on a positive note, this comes from my stack back in March and April of last year. You can see how the American public has innovated throughout the vaccine, the pandemic. And we really hope that the public health society gets more innovative and starts talking about lifestyle changes sometime between America lives on Dunkin' Donuts versus the real approach to health and wellness in the wintertime in particular, as we can see on the right side. Hopefully that they'll get the message and realize that we'll need to have more more public health education and less vaccine mandates, although, again, vaccines have been pretty effective over time, but they're just not going to answer. They're not going to be the primary solution to this particular pandemic. And I do want to shout out to a book by Pamela Smith, who's one of the senior most people at A4M. This is a book she wrote in August. It's on Amazon, and it's a paperback, a $15 paperback. But it has a real analysis of the immunology of inflammation, for which she's an expert in. She's also an expert in autoimmunity, and it can explain things beautifully to the lay public. And I hope this book ultimately gets on the bestseller list, because it has a tremendous amount of useful information. It would take me multiple hours and actually multiple days to review it with any group that I was challenged with describing all this material. So thank you very much, everybody. And thanks for your patience. We've gone a little bit over. I hope you found it useful, and I'm looking forward to questions.
Good. Pat, can you unmute yourself and just
ask you to...
So there's a lot of huge amount of questions, comments, and a lot huge. Follows like this. A lot follows the divisions in our society, where people feel strongly about one way or the another. I think one of the interesting things is for those, I know for all of AAPMD and ACAM members, we all look at vitamin D, because vitamin D is so essential for oral health, and it's a very simple thing to take a vitamin D blood test. And if we can keep everybody's vitamin D levels above 60, not only would you get some protection against COVID, but you would just be healthier and probably sleep better. Right, Pat?
Exactly. I would agree with that. I would agree with that.
Right. So let's see from the and people already are asking for you to come back and do another session.
Another one. Obviously. Sure.
Yes. Right. So take a couple of questions, Pat.
Yeah. Well, there are some very complicated questions on here, Avi, as well as other ones. And a lot of these folks understand why viruses mutate, you know, in terms of survival. But what are the environmental causes for mutations of COVID? That's one of the things that seems to be really heavy duty in terms of the thought process here. And how, you know, and another idea is, if we can mean, you know, even though we're vaccinated and we're boosted, like you said, you can't boost yourself out of this,
right,
out of this disease. Can we, as practitioners, provide certain levels of protection to our patients, whether, you know, they don't feel good, and they haven't had a test coming in to see us?
You mean provide protection for you?
Yeah, and for them and us at the same time. I think that's a big concern, because people don't necessarily feel bad they're not symptomatic. Right. Omicron is like, this is there. That's why there's no substitutes in teaching.
I think the reality is that we should anticipate, every one of us should anticipate the reality that we're more likely than not going to get this virus. And so you have to go into that mode and say, listen, this is what I know can help me. And I'll try my best, you know, not to, you know, listen, why is it going, why is this the worst time? Because between Christmas and New Year's, well, what happens? You know, we all doozy it up. We all do what we need to do during the holidays, and it's an immunosuppressant. But it's not suppressing it so much. It's modulating the immune system towards being hyperactive, so it's inflammatory. So living an anti-inflammatory lifestyle for the next 2-3 months may save your life, and that's it. It's simple. It's not simple when you're exposed and you have a loved one in the hospital. I understand. I'm not trying to be crude here. All of us can be criticized for making this simple, but that's the best you can do. You can't change your genetics. You can't say, I'm going to change whether I'm going to respond to a virus with more pro-inflammatory cytokines like IL-6, IL-1, or TNF. You can't modulate that. But you can't change your genetics, but you can change the way you respond. So vitamin D is the simplest and is the one I'm most frustrated and angry by that is not discussed every single day. And the others are also fundamental. So you have to get your stack together and be ready to send it to your kids in university. Send them off before you send them back to school and have your kids be taking this, these things. But you know what changes the mutations. First of all, one of the main hypotheses for what Omicron is a combination of COVID and the flu and a regular cold. It has certain things that are not seen before. The coronavirus isn't seen more with common colds. And so it's probably the persistence of infection in the same person allows for more mutations to occur. So what does that mean? Well, someone never mounts a good neutralizing antibody reaction, so it persists in his throat cells and in his laryngeal cells and his nasal cells and is allowed to persist there and mutate over time. And then you have the confounder of things that are affecting your entire immune system. And what are the ones that we know the most about? You know about oral infections, which are massively by the biotoxins. So we're talking about biological toxins that suppress natural killer cell function, suppress the emergence of T cells that allow you to get rid of something and kill off these viruses that are in cells. And that doesn't happen. So mold is the other one. So mold, chronic oral infections, chronic sinus infections are the ones that allow this thing to ultimately get exposed in a person for weeks at a time rather than a few days, and that then it emerges with more and more mutations.
Well, I know that as a sleep apnea doc, most of my patients, especially the ones that are covered by Medicare, for instance, they don't pay for vitamin D testing. And so many of them, I just direct to doing some sort of a home testing through a kit that they can get online, poke your finger, put the drops on there. It's better. This is not going to fix your vitamin D level overnight, which we all know. It takes a number of weeks for you to slowly, incrementally raise your vitamin D to those levels. And so, you know, people want to know, do you have any suggestions on reliable and useful home testing kits for vitamin D that these patients can use and these folks can use to chart their incremental improvement in their vitamin D, which is so critical for so many things. I know that for me, vitamin D testing is one of the things that I insist upon,
right?
Because it's so important patients do. And of course, with COVID, I think it even more. So do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I don't know specific home testing things, but I think the risk of doing damage, and you're also an expert in this, the risk of doing damage by taking 10,000 units a day for the next 2 weeks is relatively, is exceptionally small. And so why don't you just do that and just get it up there? Now, I give people who have low vitamin D levels in my office, I give them 100,000 unit shot IM in the buttock. And in Germany, and one of the reasons perhaps that Germany remains fairly flat is the average clinic will give you 300,000 units IM. So they give you an extraordinarily high dose and get it up there, but it's not a danger per se. So I would just recommend taking whether or not you have access to the testing. But again, for longevity, for metabolic health, for cardiac health, it's nicer to have your vitamin D level in the upper half of the wrist than the lower half. Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely think I really shoot for 60 to 80 for everybody.
Yeah. Yes.
So those are super. Howie, you have any other questions?
I just want to, on one slide, Avi, where you had vitamin C recommendations, I think it said 500 to 1,000 grams. Milligrams?
Yeah, and that was the recommendation of this particular ICU society. And I think we would say 3 to 4 grams a day in divided dose, or 3,000 to 4,000 milligrams a day, and that's a reasonable amount for the average person. Now, you know, if you have too much vitamin C in your system by the fact that you'll want to poop, you'll just go and have a diarrhea movement and then it'll go right away. It'll go away. Now, that's a great thing if you need that little antioxidant for you to respond that way. But that's where we know we've saturated all of our vitamin C receptors, and most of us probably need 10 to 15 to 20 grams of it to have that effect. So it's fairly benign, why not do it? Now, emergency is a 1 gram thing. It's a lot of sugar, but it's, if that's what your kid wants to take, if that's what your spouse wants to take, then let them take it.
Yeah. So we're on vacation. I've gotten several calls today of people who are canceling plans because they're afraid to travel because of this upsurge. And, yes. And one of the things you say is it's very likely that everybody's going to get this sooner or later. Does it make sense to isolate and hide till the surge passes, or protect yourself and live your life? If you're not in the over 55 group, how do you live your life in the current, with what's happening at the current moment?
So again, it's individual risk. That's why turning on the news in the morning and finding out that there's a million new cases breeds a lot of fear, but doesn't breed any intelligent sourcing of information. So, so yeah, this is my individual risk. I thought I was fairly clear how you could figure that out. And I think the data from the entire 22 months suggests that lockdown or quarantining is not rational and has not been protective, except for very, very short periods of time. So right now, if you really dug in and understood why it is that quercetin, zinc, glutathione, vitamin D, resveratrol, alpha-lipoic acid, why these things are important, and then really go into a lifestyle and say, listen, I can't exercise when I go. I need to see the sun. I need to exercise to get my lymphatics moving. I need to eat properly. I mean, it's that understanding that if you can't learn these facts from this particular epidemic, you're never going to learn it, because this could have saved a lot of lives over time and will continue to save lives if we understand the relationship of inflammation to morbidity and mortality. This is an accelerant. This is a tipping point thing. So the more you can keep to that. So listen, I mean, drinking heavily is not the best idea right now. If you want to, you can't say I'm going to lock myself down and then drink half a bottle of wine a night, because you're not helping yourself any, because at some point you're going to get it, and then you've just basically messed yourself up for no reason. So go outside, get some exercise. That would be, you know, eat properly, sleep, and all these things. Get the basics done, and you'll probably take care of, you know, 80 to 90% of the risk. Understanding that you may be 82 years old and have a reason not to go to Hawaii now, because frankly, when you get sick in Hawaii, there's nowhere to get treated.
Right.
There are certain locations that you just don't want to leave because I know my doctor, he knows me. I know my hospital is close by, so it gives you a level of comfort. Now, the cruises are a different story. You know, do you want to go on a cruise or not as an individual thing? I know that Disney wants to protect all their clients by vaccinating all the 5 to 11-year-olds. I know that they've taken that particular route, which seems quite ludicrous, but they've done it.
So, Pat, ask one more question. I'm going to run two polls. And while you ask that, the question, Avi answers it.
Avi, I think people are pretty much stuck on the vitamin D thing. So, you know, you say that you give X number of milligrams or IUs, you know, in the office, either IM or whatnot. But for folks here, do you recommend that they at least test and know what their level is to start before they start mega dosing?
It's not mega dosing. That's the problem.
Or dosing like between 5,000, 8,000, 10,000. I use a day.
Well, yeah, of course I do. And I think it ultimately the kits would end up costing around $25.
Yeah. I mean, I know that on the internet, they're anywhere from $25 to $60.
Yeah, I don't know the validity of them. That's the problem. But I know that it's always a reasonable recommendation.
Right.
Great. That's good. So Avi, you're... They don't, so far, 100% of the respondents to the first poll.
I paid everyone.
I hear you again.
But there's no problem.
We've been waiting to hear your update for a while.
Well, okay. Well, thank you.
One more question.
No, I think I have to also go, so I'm sorry. I got to go. Okay. Go ahead.
Well, you can go. Avi, thank you so much. And we're going to see you again.
Thank you.
Great information. And anybody
glad.
Wants to contact you, we'll give them that information. All safe trip home. Pat,
bye.
Last word?
Yeah. Thank you, Avi. Thank you so much, everybody. Happy New Year to you. Stay well. Stay safe. Take care of your families. Eat well. Sleep well. We will see you back here very shortly for our round of AAPMD.
Endeavor meeting.
And the Endeavor meeting next